Today's Wednesday, February 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Coming up, a new plan to fix America's failing infrastructure. South Africa's president says he has no intention of being recalled from office, and refugee students struggle to make it in the United States. It's all coming up for you this half hour on International Edition. Russia is determined to interfere in the November congressional elections in the United States. That's what top U.S. intelligence officials warned on Tuesday. Dan Coats, director of National Intelligence, told the Senate Intelligence Committee that Russia sees the midterm election as a potential target for influence operations. Coates said that Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran pose the greatest cyber threats to the United States. The intelligence officials said they all agreed with a January 2017 U.S. intelligence assessment that Russia tried to influence the 2016 election in favor of President Donald Trump. Senator Mark Warner, the ranking Democrat on the panel, said while many questions remain about Russia's actions in the 2016 vote, there is broad bipartisan consensus on the intelligence panel that Moscow engaged in a coordinated attack to undermine U.S. democracy. Mr. Coates was asked which U.S. agency was responsible for countering Russian influence operations on social media platforms.
There's no single agency quote, in charge. There are several agencies throughout the federal government that have equities in this, and we are working together to try to integrate that process. It clearly is something that needs to be addressed and addressed as quickly as possible.
Christopher Wray is director of the FBI. He responded to the effort to stop Russian influence.
I would agree with Director Coates. I think it's a team effort. And one of the things that's really jumped out at me since being back in government is how much more of a team the intelligence community is than the last time I was in this space. I have one of Mike's people who sits right, you know, in my inner team and vice versa, and we're dealing with each other, you know, every day. So it's teamwork within the intelligence community and then partnership with the private sector, which is, I think, the other big change I've noticed is a lot more forward-leaning engagement with the private sector in terms of trying to share information and raise awareness on their end, because at the end of the day, we can't fully police social media, so we have to work with them so that they can police themselves a little bit better as well.
Republican Senator James Risch said that Americans are aware of the threat.
Yeah, I think the American people are ready for this. I think that now they're going to look askance a lot more at the information that is attempted to be passed out through social media. The American people are smart people. They realize that there's people attempting to manipulate them, both domestically and foreign. I agree with everybody on the panel that this is going to go on.
Tuesday's Senate intelligence hearing also produced news on another story. This time, the departure of White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter following allegations of spousal abuse. The White House has been insisting that they didn't know about the allegations against Porter from his two ex-wives and that the FBI was still conducting its background check. Not so, said FBI Director Christopher Wray. He told senators that Porter's background check had been completed long ago and delivered to the White House, with the FBI refusing to grant Porter permanent security clearance. That knocks the ball back into the White House's court. Staying in the United States for the moment, America's infrastructure is crumbling. U.S. President Donald Trump on Monday unveiled his long-awaited $1.5 trillion plan to tackle the nation's infrastructure, meeting with state and local officials to discuss the initiative. For many local communities, that money can't come fast enough. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports from Pittsburgh.
In December of 2015, this piece of local history took a fall. The city of Pittsburgh's Greenfield Bridge became one of thousands of critical infrastructure projects then underway in the United States. Projects like fixing the 95-year-old bridge are too expensive for most local communities to finance themselves. Without help from the federal and state governments, this project couldn't happen.
We need it. Everyone needs it, not only here in Pittsburgh and western Pennsylvania, but all over the country. We have old infrastructure. We have failing infrastructures out there. So all the funding we can make available is great.
Top city official Guy Costa says federal money covers 80% of the repairs, with 15% coming from Pennsylvania and 5% coming from the city of Pittsburgh, which means a $19 million bridge costs the city just $1 million. President Trump campaigned on a promise that he'll ask Congress to pass legislation funding a $1 trillion overhaul of the country's decaying infrastructure. Local officials say it is long overdue.
We build out all this infrastructure, and we build absolutely nothing to maintain it. Zero. Nothing.
Pittsburgh was once an industrial town specializing in steel production. But like many older cities, urban sprawl connecting downtown Pittsburgh to the suburbs meant more money was spent on new projects and less spent maintaining older ones.
It is no different than your house, and your roof starts to leak, and you just ignore it, and you ignore it, and you ignore it. And one day you wake up and you have to replace your entire roof.
But the bureaucratic process is slow.
A lot of the funding, you know, from the time that it's approved in Washington and it gets to the local level could be years. And then from there you have to go into a four-year design process.
This infrastructure project affects nearly 20,000 people. And that's just one bridge in a city of some 300,000 people. Imagine this all over the country.
With progress comes inconvenience. The thousands of commuters who use the Greenfield Bridge now drive through once quiet suburbs.
It has created such a mess and such a disturbance that I've considered selling my house. It's awful.
The Greenfield Bridge reopened in October 2017 with funds approved by the Obama administration. The fate of the nation's 58,000 other at-risk bridges now depends on President Trump convincing Congress to make his campaign promise become a reality. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Here are some of the top stories we're following at this hour. The United States urges the UN to hold Myanmar accountable for treatment of Rohingya Muslims. President Trump threatens trade action on aluminum imports. Kosovo's president expects a historic agreement with Serbia this year, and millions celebrate Valentine's Day around the world. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more on our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists from the Technical University of Denmark provide new evidence that cosmic rays play a role in cloud formation, thus affecting our climate. Cosmic rays are a form of fast-moving, high-energy radiation that emanate from the sun or from sources even light years away from our solar system. According to the study, as cosmic rays interact with the atmosphere, they produce ions, charged atomic particles, that help form and grow cloud condensation nuclei, which are particles needed to produce clouds. The Danish scientists write that the number of these cloud condensation nuclei varies whenever ionization in the atmosphere changes. The presence of these particles can alter the properties of clouds, and the study suggests more particles can mean more clouds, a colder climate, and vice versa. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition, coming to you live from Washington on the Voice of America. I'm Doug Bernard. South Africa's ruling party says it has decided to recall Jacob Zuma as the country's president, although there is no sign that Mr. Zuma plans to comply with the decision. Zuma is under no constitutional obligation to agree to the party's wishes. Mr. Zuma has been plagued by corruption allegations, coupled with South Africa's economic decline since he assumed the presidency in 2009. VOA's Southern Africa correspondent Anito Powell is in Johannesburg and spoke with our Sarah Williams about the political crisis there.
This is a parliamentary democracy, so the president or the head of state is the representative of the ruling party. So we don't vote directly for a man or a woman to be our president. We vote for the party that has put up its candidate that will be the president. So what the African National Congress, the ruling party, has done is told Jacob Zuma, we don't want you to be deployed, that's their term, to that top position anymore. We want you to step back. So that is what they've done by recalling him. So they want him to resign as president. But what's very interesting is he has no legal obligation to do so.
How has Mr. Zuma so far responded to this?
So that's a great question, because Mr. Zuma, President Zuma, is a pretty gregarious guy, but he's completely gone to ground. The last time we saw him, and I saw him directly myself, was in Cape Town on Wednesday, and he emerged from Parliament right after they canceled the State of the Nation address and waved enigmatically to the crowd that had gathered and left. So he hasn't responded publicly. He hasn't appeared publicly to tell anybody what he thinks of this. Here's what we know, though. The African National Congress briefed us today, and what they told us was that they've had many positive and productive and fruitful discussions with Zuma, and that what he's asked for is a longer notice period. He wants to stay in the job for 3 to 6 months. However, the ANC feels strongly that that is just too long, and they want him out immediately. And there's several reasons for that. There's just too much political instability right now. He's increasingly unpopular, and the ANC is now staring down about 18 months to get themselves into shape for critical national elections in 2019. And his sliding unpopularity has been their biggest liability. So they want him out sooner rather than later.
What has led to this? Why is Mr. Zuma in this position where, you know, the ANC wants him to step down?
So that is actually a great question. Today at the press briefing, a South African journalist asked the ANC, well, what made you decide now, after years of defending Jacob Zuma, that you need him to leave? And that's a very interesting question that actually the Secretary General of the ANC sort of dodged and deflected. Here's what we know. The ANC replaced Jacob Zuma as the party leader. That's not unusual. His term as party leader had come to an end. They replaced him in December with Cyril Ramaphosa, the deputy president, who's a much more popular, likable, credible figure in the eyes of many South Africans. And so what they want is they want to transition to bring in a president who's much more popular, who's much more accepted by the people. This is politically expedient. But there is a rich history of corruption allegations that have swirled around Jacob Zuma for at least a decade, more than a decade, including 783 charges of corruption that may well come back to haunt him, and we may see him in court in the coming months or years or whatever, facing these corruption charges.
Anita, has the ANC given Mr. Zuma a deadline, and is there any indication as what they will do next?
So, Ace Madishule, the Secretary General of the ANC, was very clear in saying, on the one hand, we have not given President Zuma a deadline to respond to this recall notice. But then he said, just a few minutes later, the president will respond tomorrow, meaning Wednesday. Tomorrow is when we are sure he's going to respond. So it's really not clear. It sounds like they're expecting him to respond tomorrow, but that's not a deadline. But we may have some sort of movement or resolution by Wednesday.
VOA's Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. The White House this week denied an Israeli statement that the two countries have discussed the possibility of Israel's annexation of Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. The comments by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came during a closed-door session with his Likud party. A White House spokesperson says that the statement is false and that President Donald Trump's focus remains squarely on his Israeli-Palestinian peace initiative. Mr. Netanyahu's office offered a clarification that said the Israeli leader had only updated the Americans on proposed legislation in the Israeli parliament. Settlements are currently under military jurisdiction. That's been the case since 1967. The controversy came as Mr. Trump spoke by phone with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, on working with both Israelis and Palestinians on a peace plan. Mr. Putin was hosting a meeting of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who said he won't cooperate with Washington following Mr. Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Russell Stone, professor emeritus at America University's Center for Israel Studies, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it's just a matter of news being made where there is no news.
It's clear that settlements have been a topic of discussion between Americans and Israelis and within the Israeli political leadership for a long time, and there's even been discussion between Israeli leadership and Palestinian leadership over it. The current news apparently resulted from a proposed piece of legislation from some right-wing legislators in Israel that will probably go nowhere.
A Palestinian spokesman for President Mahmoud Abbas said any annexation would, quote, destroy all efforts to try and save the peace process.
That's no different from previous statements by Palestinian leadership. Once it comes up in the news, they have an obligation to respond, so that's what we're seeing.
Israel, of course, has occupied the West Bank since the 1967 war. They haven't really moved to annex, but they continue to develop these settlements that are really a roadblock, if you will, to any kind of peace process, are they not?
To some they are. To some it's a necessity that has to be recognized and accepted by the Palestinians and the world community. Now, it's not true that Israel has not annexed territory. They have annexed areas around Jerusalem to make a Greater Jerusalem municipality area. But the massive settlement enterprise that's taken place since then and which has accelerated in recent years simply means that the longer any move toward peace is deferred, the larger a problem the settlements will be.
President Trump spoke to his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin Monday in a phone call. Said it's now time to work toward a peace agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians. How likely is a Russian involvement in such efforts?
There's always been a recognition that Russia is one of the potential major players in any mediation. So there's nothing new there. I think it's mostly just a recycling of the same issues without any movement forward.
Palestinian leader Abbas was in Moscow speaking with Mr. Putin Monday. He said he could no longer accept the role of the United States as a mediator in talks with Israel because of Washington's behavior. He wanted an expanded new mediation mechanism to replace the Middle East Quartet.
That's, of course, a response to President Trump's statement about recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Again, nothing de facto has changed in that, but it's created a great deal of controversy and news. What he's saying is that the Quartet, which now consists of the United States, Russia, representatives of the United Nations, and representatives of the European Union, that the United States would be replaced in that. But the likelihood of that happening is also fairly slim.
Russell Stone also said that the White House still has not unveiled its plan for Israeli-Palestinian peace. He said while Prime Minister Netanyahu has already endorsed it, he doubts the Israeli leader knows anything about its contents. In the past, Mr. Trump has suggested he will back whatever the two sides agree to. He also called an Iranian drone's piercing of Israeli airspace and subsequent Israeli raids on Iranian and government targets in Syria and the downing of an Israeli warplane a serious new development.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hey, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition coming to you live from Washington on the Voice of America. Finally today, journalist and writer Helen Thorpe spent one school year in a classroom with immigrant and refugee students who had come from different cultures and were just learning to speak English. She watched those newcomers overcome challenges and work hard to succeed in school and beyond. Thorpe shares their stories in a new book that she spoke with about to Faiza El-Masri. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Sitting in room 142 at South High School in Denver, Colorado, gave Helen Thorpe an opportunity to meet the world. The class included 22 foreign students who came from Mozambique, Burma, Eritrea, El Salvador, Mexico, Iraq, Congo, Bhutan, Tajikistan, and Mauritania.
They had like the ordinary struggles of teenagers everywhere, plus this extra added burden of being in a new country and trying to figure out a new culture and trying to figure out a new language all at the same time. There were 14 different languages represented in the room among the 22 students. Many of the students were the only one in the room who spoke a given language. The majority of the students were very isolated in the classroom and just in general in their new life in America. They weren't able yet to make friends because they were just starting out learning English. And so that loneliness was something that they were all struggling to overcome.
As time went by, they were able to overcome it.
I watched that loneliness dissipate and go away as they figured out that they could use Google Translate to send text messages back and forth from their home languages to another person's home language. What they were all hungry for was to make friends, to learn how to fit in, to feel like they were accepted at their new high school, to feel like they belonged to a community.
In her book, The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom, Thorpe details some of the challenges many of these students faced. Iraqi sisters Jacqueline and Mariam were struggling with difficult memories.
Jacqueline and Mariam had witnessed car bombings. When their family fled Iraq, they went to Syria, and they survived the Syrian civil war as well as the Iraq war. Their father vanished during that time. Their mother became a single parent, and then she struggled to keep the girls safe. They fled to Turkey, and then she got the chance to resettle here in the United States. So those girls coming here, this was the first opportunity they had to live in a safe home in 10 years' time.
But the sisters, like many of the students in Thorpe's book, had missed a lot of school, so were working hard to succeed now that they were back in a classroom.
Solomon and Methuselah, they were living on the eastern side of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And their family was forced to flee because of chronic armed conflict to a refugee settlement in Uganda. And they stayed there for 7 years. And then just Solomon and Methuselah, their siblings and their parents, they were the only members of their extended family to get the chance to resettle in the United States. They were desperate to have a better lifestyle, a chance to stay in school. But at the same time, I think they felt a little guilty that the rest of their family didn't get the same chance.
The first time I stepped in newcomers, I was asking myself, why am I here? And I realized I'm here to learn.
Methuselah will graduate from high school next year. He credits his classmates for helping him feel at home.
I learned the most from the students who I met in the school halls and cafeteria while eating lunch with them.
His brother Solomon says that wasn't easy.
I wasn't speaking any English. I wasn't even say hi. But we had a nice teacher who liked to teach, and he knows how to teach.
Eddie Williams is an extraordinary teacher. His greatest skill was working one-on-one with individual students.
In her book, Thorpe explains how Williams kept each student interested in learning and working to reach their potential.
He really wanted to make sure that all the kids in his care understood that if they didn't know English when they walked into his room, that was perfectly okay with him. And he understood that they nonetheless were highly intelligent and possibly spoke many other languages, and that he would appreciate them and show them respect and dignity. He worked very, very hard to communicate that.
Thorpe notes that while South High School gave those students a chance to gain knowledge, the newcomers gave their classmates the chance to learn about the world. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And revisiting our top story at this hour, with U.S. congressional primary elections just weeks away, Top intelligence officials have warned that Russia appears intent on trying to disrupt the 2018 vote as much as it did during the 2016 presidential election. The heads of six major intelligence agencies told the Senate Intelligence Committee on Tuesday that Moscow sees the midterm elections as a potential target for influence operations. Quote, at a minimum, we expect Russia to continue using propaganda, social media, false flag personas, sympathetic spokespeople, and other means of influence to try to exacerbate social and political fissures in the United States, said Dan Coats, Director of National Intelligence. Well, that is our program for today. Thanks so much for being with us, for all of us here in Studio 25. Take care, and we'll see you again tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia Michael Rayner opened a three-day regional U.S. alumni global health workshop on February 6, 2018, in Addis Ababa. The workshop brought together 22 alumni of U.S. government-sponsored exchange programs from Ethiopia, Lesotho, Malawi, Swaziland, and Tanzania, with the aim of sharing best practices for communicating public health information. The workshop also provided participants with tools to promote health-seeking behavior through the use of data and health communication strategies and would support the development of a community of exchange alumni who are active in public health. Ambassador Rayner told the participants, "When we fail to provide for the health of our citizens, we feel the pain beyond the effects of illness itself. We see the harm when children are unable to attend school. We count the cost to families when parents are unable to work. And we endure the lost opportunity of lives cut short and of people marginalized or stigmatized by disease. You're here because you understand these challenges and are already making a difference." The ambassador added, "Like you, the United States has long recognized the importance of a cooperative and multidisciplinary approach to tackling global health challenges. Agencies as diverse as USAID, the Centers for Disease Control, the Peace Corps, the Department of Defense, and State Department's Refugee Bureau are working from a variety of angles to improve the health of people in Africa and around the world. All of these agencies are part of the U.S. Embassy team in Ethiopia, working in close coordination with the Ethiopian government, civil society, non-governmental organizations, and the donor community." Ambassador Rayner told the workshop participants that by the year 2050, Africa's population will exceed 2 billion people, with over 70% below the age of 35. Meeting the needs of 2 billion people is not something any of us can do on our own. The United States is committed to doing our part, but it'll take strong partners and strong leaders like you working here on the continent to get the job done. You will also need each other, which is why gatherings like this one are so important, said Ambassador Rayner. You certainly have my commitment of support and that of my colleagues and government.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.